Hello, welcome to the Your Ability podcast from the Disability Staff Network. We're part of the Staff Network overarching networks. And today we've got a slightly different podcast. Normally we have people from the Disability Staff Network talking to us and having discussions and conversations. But today we thought we'd do something slightly different in that we have two colleagues with us today who have both suffered from long COVID and have done so for quite a substantial time. So we've got Julie and we've got Adrian, and I've also got Dave in the room. So if I just get them to introduce themselves. So Julie, do you want to just say hello to everybody?
Hello, my name is Julie Hughes. I work on base at Blocksridge Hospital on Cedars Ward. I'm a healthcare support worker, and I've been there for about nearly 18 years.
Adrian?
Hello, everyone. I'm Adrian Kearns. I'm the Senior Project Manager for ICT and help look after operations, projects and capital and stuff. I've been with the organisation for almost 7.5-8 years now.
And most people who've listened to the podcast will know Dave, but I'm just going to get Dave to introduce himself.
Hi, I'm Dave Stocks. I'm the co-chair for the Disability Staff Network. I've been an expert by experience for the Trust in previous life, so to speak, and I'm now working for the Trust as a suicide prevention community development worker.
And my name is Chris Quadling. I'm the chair of the Disability Staff Network. So, long COVID then. So there's obviously been a lot of talk around long COVID initially. So initially people didn't really believe that it was a thing. It then became something more in the media. There were massive movements upwards from the patients into the medical fraternity. And I think it's starting to become a thing that people are taking very serious now. I think it's probably, I would argue, the thing that is quite a scary bit of COVID, because it's sort of something that stays around and can stay around and be quite disabling for a sustained period of time. So what I was wondering is, if Julie, do you want to give us sort of a bit of an idea of what happened to you and sort of where it all started and how it came to where you are now?
It's a bit of a long one. My husband originally felt poorly in January, the end of January last year. He got cold. He'd already had his first injection, his first COVID jab. I, on the other hand, couldn't have mine because I suffer with certain allergies, and they wouldn't give it to me. The hospital wouldn't give it to me at the manor where I went for it. He'd had his. He literally got a cold, and it was only by chance, and I said to him, just do a test, just to be sure. He did the test and he was positive straight away. I did a test and was still negative at that time, and I felt okay. My husband just had a cold. He was fine. He isolated in upstairs in the bedroom. By the Monday morning, I woke up about 2:30 and felt absolutely dreadful. I thought, to be honest, I'd got chest pains. I couldn't breathe properly. I just felt I'd got all my joints ached. I felt really dreadful. So I thought I did a test straight away, and that was still negative. So I sent for a PCR test, and that came back positive. But I knew that I'd got COVID at that stage. I stayed in bed. I couldn't really get out of bed for all the time. I felt poorly. I lost the use of my left arm. I couldn't even lift a cup with it. I'd no strength in it. I lost muscle strength in my legs. I've got a really bad hacking cough, breathlessness, chest pain. I didn't go to the hospital. Obviously, I stayed at home. And really, I had for about 10 months, really, I felt really poorly. I couldn't go to work. I was off work for 10 months in all, with breathlessness, joint pain, muscle pain. the cough, the breathlessness, and it sort of lasted for the whole of the, you know, the 10 months really, where I've really struggled to sort of carry on with daily, my daily living. I didn't ever think I'd go back to work, to be fair, as I felt at that stage. Luckily, the work, you know, my managers have been really, really supportive of me. They've been okay. My GP was really supportive and you know, did really everything they could to help me. They got me involved in a long COVID clinic through the NHS, which was like a 6-week course where once a week we all got together, people who were experiencing the same symptoms, which, you know, it did help. It was just nice to talk to people who had the same symptoms as what I'd got. And really, that's my story. I'm still suffering now, as in I get breathless going upstairs. If I do too much, I get really tired. But that's really my story.
So this would have been very early on when people didn't understand as much about COVID, didn't they?
Yes.
So was it, and I think there was a lot of fear still around from how I remember it and what I felt. So were you fearful at that time of what was going to happen to you?
I think because it was the unknown, and my GP was very, I mean, although she was very good, my GP, she wouldn't prescribe any medication for me, any painkiller. She said, we don't know what it is. You know, we it's new to us. We're all dealing with this. You know, it's a new thing. So really, I feel that I suffered quite a lot for the whole time, because no one seemed to know what to do or how to deal with it, how to treat it. And I mean, some people say it's not long COVID, you know, how can you be long COVID? What's long COVID? And I think it was the, you know, no one knew what it was. So it was quite scary thinking, you know, how was it going to, you know, generate in me? Was I ever going to get better? Was this going to be me for, you know, the rest of my life? No one knew. So it was quite scary.
Yes, what I was alluding to earlier, that it really was a ground up sort of approach from patients, wasn't it? The taste and smell came from patients, from people's experiences, and that started to shift sort of medical opinion and opinion within government. Adrian, so I don't know if you wanted to add anything to Julie in terms of sort of the medical model around that, or if you just wanted to give an overview of what you experienced.
I would just like to ask Julie a question. The term Chris used resonated with me, fearful. Did you feel that your colleagues thought you were malingering and swinging the lead and taking advantage of a syndrome? Was it difficult to come out?
It was difficult for, I mean, obviously I've got my close friends who kept in touch all through, you know, throughout my, you know, when I was off work, and they sort of like understood. But then you do get the, you know, people, when you talk to people, you know, like, you do feel like you're sort of like swinging the lead a little bit, and you know, they don't understand, you know, when I was saying, you know, I can't physically do this anymore, and they look at you and say, well, really? But you know, and it is quite fearful, yeah, thinking that no one really understood what I was going through.
And there's that moment the penny drops and you understand invisible disability, don't you?
Definitely. Yes, because even though now I feel okay as such, I still struggle with breathlessness. I'm still not doing the things that I used to be able to do, but people don't understand that. They don't. They say, "Oh, come on, pull yourself together, carry on." You know, I mean, do you want to do this? No, well, I can't do it. I can't do it yeah. anymore. So it is hard.
It's really interesting, isn't it? Because some people who have a disability and an invisible disability, you're effectively describing what people might go through on a day-to-day basis, and that sort of arguably discrimination and or lack of understanding. So it's really interesting. For my naive assumption is both of you not having a disability previously, and then there's a whole conversation around should long COVID be a disability. So in my view, there's a fairly simple mechanics in terms of the Equality Act 2010. If it affects your day-to-day living over a certain period, normally that's a year, then it's classed as a disability. So I think there are conversations around long COVID and what that then means for long COVID.
Yeah, I would agree, Chris, and I personally class it as a disability. It fits with the Equality Act definition. And also we've made our disability staff network open to anyone with long COVID. So
absolutely. Anyone
with long COVID is more than welcome to join. What
and?
I've noticed about people who've suffered with COVID or all long COVID is the mental health impact, not just the physical health, but it's affected your mental health as well. Have you found, Julie, that it's affected your mental health?
I did, yes. I think it's because I can no longer do the things I used to do. And then obviously my husband's been quite poorly as well now, but not with COVID. And then that's affected me as well, because thinking as I've put all that pressure onto my husband, because he looked after me and he, you know, he supported me throughout my illness. It's frustrating. I think it's just frustrating that people don't understand, you know, what you've been going through, how you've gone through it, how you've come out the other side. If you've come out the other side, and even now, and I get quite breathless, you know, even at work. And I think, you know, people must look at me and think, oh, you look fine. I'm not saying they do, but that's how it affects me. It's the way that the perception people have of me now. So, yeah, it does affect my mental health. As you know, strangely, I don't like silence anymore. That's really, you know, that's a weird thing for me. I don't like anything to be silent. I don't like it. I don't know why that is. I just don't. And that's a new thing.
Yeah, it's good you've got me and Chris here, because it won't be silent. So. but yeah, I mean, the mental health. I mean, you suddenly come down effectively with a disability, and it's got to take a huge toll, because now your life is totally different to what it used to be, and that must have a profound effect. Adrian, do you find similar?
Do you want me to recap what Julie just did on my journey?
Yes.
Yeah. Shall we go through your journey? Because otherwise we're sort of in the dark about you. So if you go through your journey, and then we can sort of open these questions again afterwards.
So I got COVID in the first wave, the first November. And it was mild. It was like a mild flu, but I'd lost my sense of taste and my sense of smell. And I just felt really, really tired. And I just, and that was when all the testing wasn't quite sorted. So my first PCR test came through. It was missing all the liquids in the vials. Got a second one. That came through. Missing all the labels to send it back. Got the third one through. Disappeared. I'm thinking I'm making it up. And then 2 or 3 months later, I still can't taste or smell anything. And the thing is, I have like cooking competitions with my friends where we all do stuff. I can't smell or taste. I've got about £300 of really expensive spices in the house. I've got £2,500-£3,000 of professional chef's equipment. And the missus banned me from cooking because I was making some horrible, horrible dishes. They tasted fine to me. Then all of a sudden I just joint pain, cramps, digestive problems, and then going 200 metres to and from the local Sainsbury's around the corner from where I live was taking me 30 minutes. I used to play 4 hours of squash solid, and I'd do my weights at home, and I could lift 25 kilograms in each hand and do French curls and stuff. Now I struggle to walk to the shops and take 2 litres of water back home with some food for us, and it kills me. And I've got some good relationship with the high street people on the store on the route, and even they've noticed. And mental health, first time in my life, I reached out to the wellbeing services for the trust, because I was
really, really struggling. I was scared to let my colleagues know. I was scared to let my partner know. I was scared to let my manager know because nobody believed it. So I pretty much have everything, the COVID toes, the pains, the cramps. What I've been lucky with is I don't have lung damage and I don't have the mental fogs. But I spent the best part of the first year making sure I'd got just enough sleep, because I've done about 2.5 hours sleep a night uninterrupted to get through the working day. And then I would just pass out for about 4 hours. And it wasn't hard on me. It was hard on Sarah, who was looking after me. Sarah's my partner. And to this day, I have to set 2 alarms during the day to make sure I drink a litre of water at certain times. And I need to set an alarm to make sure I have lunch. And Sarah makes sure I eat, because I've lost all thirst and appetite responses. It's 2 years in now. I still can't taste. I still can't smell. Last week, I forgot to eat for 4 days in a row because Sarah was out looking after her mother. And then it just sort of cascades. I get weaker. I get less appetite and stuff like that. And for a long time, I think I'm a strong person, but it broke me as a person mentally. And then I think it was a fair few months back, and I ended up phoning my boss and actually confessing how bad I was. So once he realised how bad the situation was, Sean, bless his heart, changed things around for me to support me. And then I started opening up to my team. But by this time, non-COVID had become recognised because of all the stuff that was going on. And I've got to say to you, the guys who report into me and my peers were absolutely outstanding. And they could see it in me when I started joining face calls again. You could see it in my face at the time. And they looked after me and they took workload off me. And I'm a bit emotional. And they really did help me. And then November this year, there was a big capital planning meeting. And I couldn't make it to Trafalgar House where everybody was in person, because I just physically couldn't. I couldn't sit in a meeting for 2 hours. I mean, I struggled to do anything for 30 minutes. I joined in on the conference call and everybody turned around to me and said, "Adrian, you're not well enough to work. Turn off." So that hurt, because I felt I wasn't capable or competent of doing my job. But they had my best interests in heart. And strange enough, after that point, the doctor signed me off for 3.5 weeks. I got some medications and stuff. I'm slowly getting better. But what I've realised is, I hadn't given the trust or my colleagues the chance to support me because I was scared. I was genuinely scared, and I was wrong, because they did look after me. And now I still can't smell. I still can't taste. I get breathless. I'm still occasionally passing out for basically 3 or 4 hours, but I'm learning to live with it. So it's for me. The doctor's gone through everything, so I haven't got cancer, I haven't got autoimmune disease, I haven't got a mesentery ischemia, I haven't got cancer, I haven't got this, I haven't got strokes. But it really hit me when the doctor sent me to A&E because he thought I was going to die. And my sats are still like 92, 94 with a heart rate of 100 from being like 98 and a 60 beats per minute when I'm really active. But I'm learning to live with it, and that's because of the support of the trust of my colleagues. And I don't feel scared now to, if I'm having a bad day, I can phone up the boss and my teammates and say, you know, cut me a bit of slack, cover for me. And I think it's not just long COVID, it's all long-term conditions, because I've got colleagues I'm supporting with it. And it finally struck me, if I'm doing my best to support them, why couldn't I believe that my managers and my execs would do their best to support me? So that's been my journey. But my journey's been supported predominantly by Sarah. And when I finally had the courage to open up, my team stood behind me and my peers and all the people I work with in various functions. And that's what makes me so emotional. People were looking after me and they cared, but I had to step up and say, help.
That's a really important lesson, isn't it?
Yeah. It brings up the whole subject of disclosure. One thing that we have within disabilities is whether people disclose or not. I've suffered from it in the past when I've worked at Walsall at Dorothy Patterson's. I struggled to disclose that I had a mental health condition because I've been an inpatient at Dorothy Patterson's. And it's really hard to do that disclosure. But it's so important. It's so important because people are there, are out to support you. If you don't share that with other people, they can't be there to support you. So it's so important that being brave enough to open up and share that you are suffering and you just need a little help because you've always been there for other people. Likewise, other people will be there for you. So it's just admitting you need that little help. But it must have been really, really difficult for someone so active to suddenly not be able to be active and also not to be able to taste and smell when you love cooking so much. I can't imagine the effect that's had on you.
I'm learning to play with textures. But the weird thing is, Sarah used to shout at me. She said, you work for a mental health trust. If anybody's going to help you, it's going to be them.
What did you think was going to happen, Adrian, when you didn't want to tell others? What was the fear? What was stopping you?
I have quite a lot of responsibility and have to make some critical decisions, particularly around funding and strategy and where we're going with the support of other peers and stuff. And I really started to worry that people would, as Julie said, people would think I'm malingering, pulling the lead, and my opinion and what I was suggesting would be devalued. And the fact I was struggling sometimes with being alert, not mentally active, but the energy to deal with stuff. And I thought if people knew, I wouldn't be able to do my job, but they didn't, oh, I love the dog. I didn't think they would think I could do my job. And part of who I am is what I do for a living and what I deliver. And that was the fear for me. I don't know whether that's the same for you, Julie.
I think people, because you work in mental health anyway, I think people just assume that you're not going to suffer with your own mental health because you understand everything. They think you know everything about mental health, so it's not going to affect you. I mean, like my husband's, you know, he's not been well. Do you know what I mean? And I do put that down to me. I think I've put loads of pressure on my husband.
Yeah.
So he has been really struggling with his mental health. And you know, it's like, well, you know, and he did say to me, he said, well, you know, you've been my rock, you've been there for me, and you know what you're talking about. And I'm like, oh, and it's physically draining, and I feel so guilty. So you know that he's there for me, and then all of a sudden he's struggling, and I don't think I'm physically well enough to be able to support him, and I feel really guilty about it. It's awful. No, but the perception is that you know what you're talking about, you know how to deal with it, and you don't. You need that extra help.
I have to say that there is a lighter side to it. Once I'd got the courage and confidence to open up and my team was supporting me and my peers, about 4 months ago, I had to put some security lights up above the front door. So I was on a set of step ladders, and as Julie will probably understand this, sometimes you just run out of energy. So I fell off the step ladders, crashed to the floor, and broke two toes. But I shared it with the team and said, this is what happens when your batteries run out. And everybody had a good laugh about it, and then told me off for doing stuff. but they did look after me. And then I would say last October, because I hadn't been able to eat meat, I couldn't digest it for a long time, I decided bacon. I haven't had bacon for a long time, and I love bacon. So I bought some really expensive dry cured bacon, and I did my like posh sandwiches with all the fillings and stuff. And Sarah comes downstairs, and it's 7 o'clock at night, and I'm sat there and I'm sobbing my eyes out, absolutely sobbing my eyes out, because I can't taste the bacon, and I'm eating this soggy sandwich. And I shared that with the team, and everybody had a good laugh about it. But because I've been open about it, and I honestly believe the trust supports me, I've got my back, and my peers and colleagues do, I can find some humour, and I can find a way to live with what for me is a long-term condition. And I do hope, if this podcast goes out, that other people with long-term conditions that aren't just long COVID, other people with invisible disabilities, come forward and seek help. Because I'll tell you now, Chris, Dave, Julie, the IT team, we support about 10% of our staff with adaptive services, software and equipment. None of their managers know. None of their colleagues know. We know, and we look after them. So they need to be able to come out and ask for that help that I got. And I believe it's there in our organisation. I really do.
Absolutely. I mean, we've now got a new ED&I lead, Will Cooling. We've got Amina, who is his colleague, who works with him. You've got the Disability Staff Network. So you've got the reps like Julie and myself, and there are other reps as well around. So there's lots of mechanisms to tap into for what you're describing, Adrian, is obviously a reasonable adjustment if you do have a disability. So it is definitely worth having those conversations. And if you don't feel comfortable approaching a manager in the first place, there's lots of other places that you can seek that help. But what I was wondering is how do you both feel about sort of all the restrictions that are being lifted? So do you fear getting COVID again? How do you respond to the situation that we're in now in terms of, obviously, the government drive is very much open up the economy, you know, get things moving again. We need to live with COVID. That's the current messaging. But we know, obviously, that a lot of people who have health conditions who are potentially going to be housebound because they don't feel safe to go out. How does it affect you too? Do you fear that, or are you okay with things at the moment? Or
I fear it. I get really worried. I still wear a mask if I go into shops or you know, in public places. I just feel it's for my own protection. I fear that if, you know, what would happen to me if I caught COVID again. I mean, to be fair, I've just done a test today. I do it quite regularly to keep checking on myself to make sure that I'm okay. It is scary. And when people say, like, I eventually I've had my three jabs, my booster included. I've had that, which obviously that was a struggle to get the booster as well. You know, I was put off so many times with the booster. I eventually got it, and you know, and I do feel like I've got that extra bit of extra protection, but it is quite frightening to think, you know, you all of a sudden you can go out, you can, you know, no one's got to wear a mask, no one's got to do, you know, all the things that we should be doing, and it does worry me, and it really does. So I think, what if I get it again? How is it going to affect me again? Will it affect me again? I don't know. Nobody knows, and that's quite scary.
Adrian? I think I'm with Julie on this one, and I'm not a terribly fearful person. You know, I've done like rock climbing and stuff like that. So risk management and risk assessment in my personal hobbies has always been a little low. But I am generally concerned about what would happen if I got COVID again. But equally, I've got nieces and nephews. I've just got off a call with a colleague earlier today, who two of his children didn't want to go and visit the grandparents because they were scared to leave the house. And I'm thinking we do need to open up. But like Julie, Sarah and I, whenever we go to the shops, because we've been going to the same shops for like 10 years where we live, to protect the people who we know by name and stuff, who serve us, and are more than just servers. We wear masks. We're trying to protect the community. But the mental health concerns about people being locked down, and it took me a while to get less fearful about leaving the house because I've been indoors for 14 months. I don't want that to be applied to the wider population. I'm also really concerned that there's lots of people who've had 18th, 21st and 30ths and 13th birthdays who have missed out on the whole experience that we had growing up. And we need to open up, but masks, keep the masks for God's sake, please.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of things that are changing quite rapidly, aren't they? I mean, the testing, so the free testing will stop. Masks mandate has already stopped. So it is something that does need to be thought about. Arguably, and it has been argued that it's a small demographic that this affects predominantly. But I think it is the most vulnerable demographic, and it is something that I feel has been slightly lost in the recent COVID conversation and in the opening up of the country.
It might be the most vulnerable demographic, Chris, but if you lose a grandparent, a father, a mother, a brother, a sister because they were exposed to COVID and they had autoimmune suppression or the jab didn't work for them, That impact cascades across the whole family and sometimes wider communities. So there needs to be a balance. And I think the balance at the moment is on opening up everything back to normal, but without any protection for those we should be protecting. That's my personal opinion. I think people may disagree with it, but there has to be a bit of a balance.
Can I just say something? I know we need to get back to normal as such, but even people who haven't got these, these conditions, who are extremely vulnerable, I didn't class myself as a vulnerable person as such. And I was quite healthy. I used to run. I used to exercise all the time. And I was considered myself to be quite healthy and quite fit. But then to get COVID and for it to affect me the way it did for a healthy person. So even now, I think even healthy people can, it can affect them, not just the people who are vulnerable, but anybody. And I think the biggest thing for me now is when they're saying that you don't need to, it's advisory to isolate, but you don't have to isolate if you test positive. Oh my God, it just frightens me. So. You could have all these people walking around without masks, without anything at all, and they could be positive and they're passing it to. And sometimes, I think at work, I think there's going to be a massive surge. I feel there is going to be a massive surge of people now getting COVID, but because they don't have to isolate, they don't have to do this, they don't have to report it. Where is it going to go? It's scary. It really does frighten me.
Well, it's got worse now, hasn't it? I mean, with the 1.5% increase on national insurance, inflation running at 8-10%, the fuel crisis. If you do have COVID, do I isolate and protect the wider thing, or do I put food on the table for the family? And I know what I'd pick. I'd be putting food on the table for my family. I can't find any harsh judgment for people who make that choice, because it's going to get hard. Going to get hard next year. And that informs what we do with COVID as well.
And I don't disagree with you. I know this isn't a political podcast, but I think this has been the struggle, hasn't it, for your 0-hour contractors. We know it's disproportionately affected Black ethnic minority colleagues. Even through wave one, if you consider the delivery drivers who have just continued, lorry drivers, people serving in supermarkets, they've just continued, haven't they? So I'm going to draw that bit to a close now, but I was really interested. So thank you really very much for sharing sort of your stories on your journey. I'm hoping it's interesting for other people to hear this as well. I was just wondering if there's anything that has worked for you in terms of your recovery, in terms of anything that you would like to have done different from a trust perspective. Was there any different support that you needed? Is there anything that from a disability staff network you think we should be doing in a different way to support anybody who's currently got long COVID? Just any sort of final thoughts or recommendations from you?
I'll answer that, Chris. For about the last 9 months on manager's briefs, Friday Q&A, I have been saying I'm quite prepared to talk about the consequences of long COVID, the support that the trust could give, and how open and helpful they are. And time after time, nobody took any notice of it. And there are people outside of long COVID with invisible conditions, long-term conditions, who need to get the message. Our organisation will 100% look after you, but the organisation need to let the people like me and Julie and other people in the disability network send that message out and let them know their peers, their colleagues and the organisation are there to support them, because that's what we do as a business. And the trust knocked me back time after time after time. That's the only thing I'm disappointed with, the lack of an option to share how much they could support us. Through some bizarre thing, they wouldn't let me send that message out when they were doing absolutely the right thing. That's my only concern.
And Julie? Thank you, Adrian.
To be fair, my ward manager was really supportive of me, and I can't really fault that the support that she has given me throughout my sickness and being off work. As for the trust, I don't know. I don't know. I think because I had so much support from my manager, it's difficult me to say from a trust point of view. Because she was there, you know, phoning me, making sure I was okay, offering me support, and you know, so I don't know what the trust could do. I felt isolated, but I mean, that how can the trust, you know what I mean? How can they deal with that? I don't know. I really don't know.
Isn't that the point, Julie? What could the trust do? That's the message that's not got out.
Well. It's difficult. It's a difficult one because yeah. I do feel like I was supported by my ward manager. Do you know what I mean? He was my go-to person, and she was really good. To be fair, I've got to be so honest. She was really good with me.
I had the same with Sean. He absolutely had my back, but that's because he was following the trust visions and values.
So the message to the trust is: if you do have somebody who's suffering a disability and/or long COVID, in this case. Do what Julie's manager and what Adrian's manager did. That's the message. Dave, do you have any final thoughts?
Yeah, just a couple of things that Julie mentioned. One, being a mental health trust and this feeling that you are expected to understand mental health and look after yourself, and it's the service users that have the mental health problems, not the staff. Well, statistically, the staff have it as well. So always, look after your own mental health. It's really, really important. And it's an invisible disability. So share it. Your manager can't support you unless you share that. And the mental health, is a knock-on effect of long COVID. The other thing that you mentioned, Julie, was that you don't like silence anymore. And that is probably as a result of the isolation. So that's something new that's come about as regards to this chat that we're having now. And that's something that we ought to, you know, it's the social contact, the lack of social contact. So something that we want to make sure to take time to, you know, people that have been isolated away from work because of COVID, take time to give them a call, have a chat, be there for them, because it can be a lonely place when you're on your own.
That's really good point, Dave.
Yeah.
Agree.
Thank you, everybody, for sharing your stories and coming along today. I'm hoping you enjoyed this podcast. It's a slightly longer form factor than we have with our normal ones. I think it's a really important topic, and I'm glad we were able to give it the time that we have. And maybe we'll just dub it as an extra one or a special one or something like that. I'm not quite sure yet. So I'm hoping you're going to join us for our next podcast. We've got something queued up for the next one already. So keep a lookout for that one. And if there's any questions for the Disability Staff Network, please come and share and talk to us if you want to. You can be allies to the network, or if you have a disability yourself, just reach out to us and we'll add you to the distribution lists. We've got a monthly meeting if you want to come along to that as well. So thank you very much, everybody, for listening to us. And I'm hoping it's been useful, and I'll speak to you all very soon. My name's been Chris Quadling, and thank you for listening again. Bye.
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 Bye.